from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. After 17 years of marriage, after an entire life as living as an Orthodox Jew, Tova Mervis left. Her book is about her journey, how she could no longer set aside her doubts, how on one hand she felt suffocated and yet at times felt enveloped by a loving community. Mervis writes about what it's like to stand outside that community, where the punishment for not observing the rules is to be cut off from your people. She says it felt like an astronaut whose connection to a spaceship is severed. Outside the law of gravity, she writes, you endlessly float. Tova Mervis is in Utah this week. Today in the program, she's joining us to talk about her experience and the memoir she wrote about it. It's called The Book of Separation. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It must be really difficult to leave an Orthodox religious life, for all the obvious reasons, but it's also really complicated. As Tova Mervis writes in her new memoir about leaving Orthodox Judaism, there are the moments when you feel free, grateful not to be obligated or act or believe, but then there are the things you miss. In the months after she left, stopped being Orthodox, divorced her husband of 17 years, she says it surprised her how badly she wanted an invitation for a Shabbat meal. She says she was looking for a gesture to let her know that even though she was no longer inside the community, at least she might still be welcome inside. She missed the people, but mostly she says she missed the feeling of being situated inside a particular world. If the earth's spinning were halted for a minute, she writes in the memoir, I could have placed my finger on this one small spot and said, I belong here. Tova Mervis is in Utah this week, and today in the program she's joining us to talk about her book. It's called The Book of Separation. She has written three novels, we should mention, including The Ladies' Auxiliary. And she's not here long, only here for a quick signing. This evening we'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. But Tova Mervis, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I guess I want to begin. Let's begin with the get. Would you explain what that is? I mean, I think this is a really fascinating story, and it's kind of the story where you begin. This is basically this ancient, I guess, divorce ceremony.
Right. A get is the colloquial term for the Jewish bill of divorce, and it's an ancient document that is very scripted and very legalized, and every word has to be written a certain way, and a man traditionally issues it to a woman to enact a religious divorce. And for me, it was really the starting point of my own coming to know that in leaving this marriage, I was also leaving a religious world, and that so many of the questions I had about belonging to a strict religious world were really contained in this ceremony where I was given the get by my then husband and by the rabbis, where I wasn't, as a woman, an active participant in the ceremony, where I had to ask questions about what is the relationship between my own private sense of belief and this public ceremony where the rules dictated everything that happened. And so it was the starting point for me in deciding that this was really the end of many worlds for me. And in writing the Book of Separation, it was also the starting point in deciding I was going to write about this experience.
Talk a little bit about that. In the book, you write that here was the way the world was made, and here was the way the world worked. Mm-hmm. And every decision you made up to that point was stacked upon that. Mm-hmm. When did you decide you wanted to say? I mean, you're a writer. You've written novels. You've done plenty of writing. But at what point did you decide maybe I want to tell a more personal story?
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up in the Orthodox Jewish community. I actually grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, which is not usually thought of as a stronghold of Jewish communities. Yeah. But my family's been there for many generations. And two of my novels really chronicle questions of religious belonging. What does it mean to be inside of a world? What does it mean to question or quietly doubt? I always thought, maybe a novelist always has this level of denial. I thought that I was just writing it about other people. I was going to think about other characters and their own experience of grappling and doubt. But I felt that I was always inside this world, for better or worse, even when it felt complicated. I was aware, though, that I did have that quiet, private questioning, that little voice that whispered in the back of my mind, do I believe this is true? You know, do I really believe it? But, you know, as you said, my whole life was stacked upon the assumption that it was true. Yeah. And so I wasn't really willing to look at it. And then as I got older and I began to really decide I was going to wrestle with this question, I had to ask myself, am I leading a life that really matches what I privately think? And, you know, for a writer, so much of writing is about being willing to go to the hard places, to ask the hard questions, to look at things that make us uncomfortable. And so my first decision to write about it as nonfiction was an essay I wrote that was in the New York Times about the GET ceremony. And I wrote this essay first thinking it was just for myself. It was really nerve-wracking, to the idea of putting my own personal story out into the public view. And I decided to, and it was in the Times. And really right after it ran, I got hundreds of emails from people who wrote to me sharing their own stories of divorce, but mostly of religious change, of grappling with what it meant to question a religious community that you felt was your everything and that you felt held a full sense of what was true.
And you decided, okay, I'm going to go forward and do this memoir. That somehow told you that people wanted to hear this story, or maybe even some needed this story.
I did. I felt like people needed to hear a story. I think that when you question a religious faith that is your entire world, it's an immensely lonely feeling. Yeah. It's that feeling of I am the only one who feels this way because everyone around me seems to be perfectly fine and content. So I felt there was a need. I did feel personally that it was a very strange experience because I'm so accustomed to writing fiction, but I felt like I wanted to tell my own story. I wanted to tell a story not about what we're supposed to feel inside a religious world or what we're supposed to think, but my own actual experience of what it meant to grapple with this. And I think I would, when I questioned whether I wanted to write a memoir, I would go back to these emails I had received and just read them over and over. And I felt like when you are willing to tell your own story, even when it makes you feel very vulnerable and exposed, I think that is what enables other people to connect and be able to tell and own their own stories as well.
Do you remember when you first started to doubt? And I want to actually get at what you mean by doubt, because you write about this in the book. But when was the first time you doubted, and what did that mean? Was it related to the nature of God? Was it related to being in an Orthodox community? I mean, what was doubt when you first started doubting?
Right. Well, when I first started doubting, I thought doubt was the same thing as being bad. You know, to doubt or to ask questions was to be a bad girl, because the opposite, of course, to be observant was to be a good girl. And I remember, I don't know if I would call it doubt, but that question of trying to understand your own world as a child. I remember in elementary school, really, I went to the Memphis Hebrew Academy, which was a small all-Orthodox day school in Memphis. And down the street from us was a school, the St. Louis Christian Academy. And so we drove past their school on the way to our school. And we actually had the same uniforms, which was sort of always very humorous. We were so similar and yet so different.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, asking myself, you know, how sad it was, of course, for those children that what they were being taught was not true, because what I was being taught was, of course, the sole truth. And I would bat that around in my mind. And I remember the unsettling moment of thinking, but wait, they probably think the same thing about us. They probably think they have the truth and we don't. And that idea that other people experience themselves as living the only way, or that other people believe themselves to be in possession of the sole truth, was disconcerting to me as a child. It felt like this logic game or logic puzzle that I couldn't solve in the middle of the night when I would be bothered by it. And I think it grew. For me, there were many places where I was aware of a girl or woman's role in the Orthodox Jewish world that were upsetting. Mm-hmm. In the morning prayers, we said there was a part where the boys thanked God for not making them a woman. Yeah. And we said the complimentary prayer, which was thanking God for making us according to his will. And I knew they were unequal. I knew, of course, the apologetics given to me for why it might make me feel upset, but it shouldn't make me feel upset for these reasons. And I tried to make myself accept those reasons, but there was always that quiet voice that said, but does that really work? Is that really the truth? And I think it's easy to push aside those voices. Anything that can upend your world is a voice that you sometimes have to push away.
Well, you say in the book that you tried to ease your sense of doubt with the routine of ritual, which I think was really interesting that you had this doubt, but because there were so many rules and there were so many, I mean, particularly in Orthodox Judaism, and you go through these, it's fascinating, just preparing for the Sabbath for a Shabbat meal is really interesting, but you kind of settled into the routine of that and let that, I guess in some ways, ease your mind. That I guess that let you set aside your doubt for a time, I suppose.
Orthodox Judaism is really made up of so many rules. It's a very action-oriented religion. And in some ways, belief matters a little bit less. I think you could say publicly, or maybe not fully publicly, but you could say, I don't believe in this, and that would be one thing. But if you said, I don't observe these laws, that would be really problematic. There's almost a feeling that observance of the rules matters above all else. And there are many rules. There's rules about food, rules about dress, there's holidays, there's rules about the Sabbath, and really minute detailed rules. To observe the Sabbath means that I wouldn't turn lights on or off on the Sabbath. I wouldn't cook on the Sabbath. I wouldn't, you know, use electronics. I wouldn't tear toilet paper. I mean, really intense levels of detail. And so for me, I think for many people in that world, the sense of ritual observance and belonging that is created by that is what reigns supreme. It mattered more that I belonged to a community than I actually believed in its tenets.
But you write about the question of belief, and you've talked about it being kind of central. And I wanted to ask about this, because you write in the book that you tried to force back this burst of doubt, as you explain it, to locate the spot where I was getting lost. And then you go through these questions, and I wanted to ask you about some of them. Did I believe there was a God? Did I believe there was a God who was involved in the world? Did I believe there was a God who made known his teachings in oral law? Did I believe in a God who cared about the smallest details about what I ate and what I wore, you know, the scorekeeper God. Where did you locate that doubt? I mean, where are you on these questions now about God, and where were you then?
At the time, I think it was easiest to start with the bottom level question of, did I believe that there was a God who was interested in whether the food I ate had the right rabbinic supervision or not?
Yeah.
Or did I believe there was a God who was interested in that my skirt was half an inch above my knee as opposed to half an inch below my knee? That was where I first felt myself falling away. That sense that I could not fathom a God who was so interested in those details. It seemed to me those were human creations, and for varieties of human reasons, to have a sense of law that reigns supreme. I think as I went down that path, you know, one, when you open a box, there are all of a sudden lots of boxes to open.
Yeah.
And it's just the choice to look. Once you decide you're going to look, it's hard not to look at everything. And so there was that sense of walking through a door and then being in an unopened space on the other side. And so right now, I mean, several years past my own leave taking from this Orthodox world, I would probably put myself at that first question of, do I believe there's a God?
Yeah.
I think I would put myself really at that far edge of questioning of, but being willing to look at all the hard questions and to know that I don't have to have all the answers. I think inside a lot of religious communities, there's the sense that we can answer your every question. Don't worry, those only seem like challenges, but we have all the answers. And I think one of the things I've learned most is that no one has all the answers and no one has to supply them to anyone and no one can supply them to anyone. And to be able to live, I think for me, with that sense of uncertainty or unknowing, to live in a space where the world can be more complicated than any religion can offer sort of a nice, neat answer to.
There's this really interesting story you tell. And maybe you need to explain what a mikveh is. Explain what that is first, because there's this story where you almost mark your independence at this moment, because this woman says you need to comb your hair better, and you decide you're fine. And this seemed like an important moment. Would you talk about the story? Explain
Sure.
this, if you would.
Sure. Well, the mikveh is the Hebrew word for a ritual bath, which is part of the Jewish laws of family purity, they're called, or marital purity. And the idea is that for within a married relationship, when a woman has her period and for the 7 days after, she's considered impure, for lack of a better translation, and she is prohibited from any physical contact with her husband. And this time period ends when the woman immerses herself in the ritual bath.
Yeah.
And before immersing, there's a list of preparations one does. You comb your hair, you cut your nails. You're supposed to be fully immersed so that no part of your body is separate from the idea of the waters enveloping you.
And you go to a place to do this.
You go to a place,
yes.
So every Orthodox Jewish community would have a mikveh. It's sort of a central piece of an organized Jewish community. And it's a bathhouse with one or two of these baths and preparation rooms. And there's a woman who is the attendant who sort of checks you, makes sure you goes under, makes sure your nails are clipped. And when I first got married, this was sort of my introduction into this world. I had this moment of like, oh my God, do I really have to do this? But it was also, of course I'm going to do this. This is part of my world. And I think I had that sort of splitting experience of no. And yet, of course, this is who I am. And so I would go every month. I would go to the mikveh, and it was just part of what it meant to be an Orthodox woman. And I think, you know, it was one of those places. I think maybe many worlds have those moments where you feel like I'm doing something, even though so many parts of me are reacting against doing it, or I'm trying to tell myself that this is beautiful, or I'm trying to tell myself that I like this, even though I have the experience of a secret second self that revolts, or that says, no, I don't want this, or I don't like this. And yet to be part of a religious world, I felt was to suppress that voice, to say, I cannot possibly listen to this because it was an impossibility not to do this. And so I went year in and year out, but it became harder as that voice grew louder and as that sense of questioning grew stronger. And for me, the questions were, do I have to submit my own internal sense or my own internal ideas to an external version of the world? Do I have to submit my personal ideas to a religious authority? You know, where is there room for my own sense of I don't want this? As those voices grew harder, it became harder to do this ritual in particular, because it's one thing to observe the laws of Sabbath, where I would unscrew the light bulb from the refrigerator every week so I didn't accidentally turn it on. It's another thing when it's your body.
Yeah.
I think when the laws are stamped across the most intimate parts of your body, it's hard to say, well, I'll just do them and kind of go along with my life. And, you know, when I was writing the book, I tried to really ask myself, well, where are those moments? You know, I think every leave-taking, they rarely happen, you know, in one big swoop. It's usually lots and lots of small moments. And so for me, being at the ritual bath, trying to comply with rules that felt suffocating, you know, it really came to a head when the woman, the attendant, told me that my hair, I have very long, thick, curly hair that does not like to be combed very easily, when she asked me to comb my hair again and telling me that it was tangled. And it's a small moment to rebel against. You could say it's insignificant, but it was just one of those moments when I knew the answer was no, that I could not do this.
But you say this in the book, nothing in my life felt as certain as this one sentence.
Right. It's funny when we make our moments of resistance, when those moments of revolt happen. You know, until now, I would think, oh, well, I'll do it anyway. And something about that moment, I think I was at the point, really, maybe I was already at the tipping point, but I knew that I could not submit my own body to religious rules that felt punishing or that felt overly strict to me, that there was not one more part of myself that could do it for 1 minute longer.
The draw of ritual, the draw of being inside of this community, it's so intense. I'm guessing you probably still struggle with laws still binding in your head, I think is how you put it in the book. Like and there's this story that you tell after your divorce, and you are headed to a yoga retreat, but you've gotten a late start. And now you're up against the deadline of the Sabbath. Like, you don't really believe in this same way anymore, but you're looking at the dashboard clock, which tells you the deadline for the Sabbath. And you're feeling really anxious, really stressed out about this. And I think that's telling about how powerful that world is.
Well, I think when you're raised inside of a religious world that has so many rules, when it's not just something you do, but it's your full identity. It's everything you are. I think those rules don't fall away so easily. I think saying, well, I don't really believe God has an opinion about whether I arrive at 6:15 or 6:08, saying that doesn't matter very much. I think that internal experience of being shaped by the idea of good and bad and right and wrong. And so for me, the book really begins with this, with the Jewish holiday of deciding that I was not going to observe it in synagogue as I had, and driving to this yoga and meditation retreat, which is like, would be considered like, you know, she's doing what on Rosh Hashanah, on the Jewish New Year?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's hard to shed those voices, and they live inside of us for a long time. Even when technically you no longer belong to a religious world, there's still sort of this second lens through which I can always see the world. We're always, I've worked to sort of try to minimize at least that voice that sort of yammers in my mind of, oh, this is bad, this is wrong, that still holds on to that black and white way of thinking.
Tova Mervis is with us. Her memoir is called The Book of Separation. Tonight at 6 o'clock, she's going to be signing books and giving a Q&A at the Community of Christ Church in Salt Lake City. I should say she's here as a guest of the Mormon Stories podcast. There's more information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, what it's like, what it means to break from an Orthodox faith. Tova Mervis has written a memoir about her decision to leave Orthodox Judaism, which meant divorcing her husband of 17 years and setting out on this new journey. She writes about the risks, how you can lose everything you love and even more. Mervis says if you leave, it can seem as if you're in danger of losing yourself. Her book is called The Book of Separation. She's here only for today. She's going to be giving a signing books and giving a Q&A at the Community of Christ Church in Salt Lake City. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. She's joining us here in the studio. It's interesting, your attraction to your now ex-husband, Aaron. You call him Aaron in the book. You say you were originally drawn to boys who were dark and stormy, and he was not that at all. He didn't really have the hard edges. You're 22 when you met him. So what was your interest in him, that he represented something safe?
I think I was 22 and part of an Orthodox Jewish community where getting married young was the norm. I was also a senior in college, and I had that question of, like, what comes next? Until now, everything had been mapped. You know, you do this, and you do this, and you do that. And if you follow all the rules, everything will, of course, turn out perfectly, was what I was sort of raised to think. And we met. We were set up on a blind date. We were seen as being exactly the same. And we had that same feeling that we were so similar religiously. We felt like we were just the same part of the same world, that we fit together easily.
But wait, explain what that is, because I think this is interesting. Yes, you were Orthodox, and yes, you followed the rules, but you were willing to bend the rules a bit, at least at first. That was one of the things that you kind of could relate to together.
Right. Well, Orthodox Judaism has so many different streams and strands to it. You could divide it, and you could divide those divisions even further. You could parse the world until it's very small. So we were part of, like, a modern Orthodox, slightly left-leaning modern Orthodox Jewish community. And so what that meant was that we were part of the secular world. We both had attended secular colleges and were very much part of secular culture, but also maintained a strict adherence to religious rules. And there was always that feeling that you could somehow bind these two worlds together, or you could let them exist. And so we were both strictly Orthodox, but I think, you know, maybe many religious worlds have this, that sense that I am this, but privately I might not be perfect in my observance, although we felt bad about it. You know, some people might do that blatantly and not care. I wasn't perfect in my observance, but was religious enough that I felt ashamed of those slippages or those moments of lapses.
Yeah. And you tell a moment when you kissed, which was completely forbidden.
Kissing a boy, I was 17 years old, and the first time I kissed a boy, I thought I was probably the worst person in the entire universe. I thought that I was, you know, shameful in every way. And those messages were so intense that this is wrong, and it's absolutely wrong. And so we were set up because we were seen as similar. We were religious, but we weren't. We both, I think, had a softness to us. Neither of us had that sort of maybe certainty or stridency to us. We were a little softer around the edges. And so we dated for 12 weeks. And in my 22-year-old's mind, I thought, well, I'm like him. We're the same. I love him. He loves me. You know, I'm only 22, but what could possibly go wrong? I mean, how else could this end but happily?
Yeah.
And, you know, I try to sometimes reimagine my younger version of myself where I just thought, well, this is the way life goes. This is the way it's supposed to look. And so I will do what is expected of me. I also think that I was tremendously scared of uncertainty. Getting married at a young age in my religious world, it closed off the possibility that I would end up as one of those, you know, Orthodox singles who were unmarried, you know, at the ripe old age of 25.
Right.
You know, the fear, the terrible fear that I would be unmarried, you know, to be 30 and be not married. I mean, it was unfathomable to me, that fear. And so this was a way around that. And I think that I got married. It wasn't so much a question of not knowing each other. I think there was that too. But I didn't know myself yet. I didn't yet know what it meant that sometimes I did question, or what did it mean that I wanted to be a writer and I believed in the idea of artistic freedom.
And feminism.
I was an Orthodox feminist, which there are Orthodox feminists. It was a complicated mix of adjectives to sort of throw together sometimes.
Yeah.
What would that look like over the long run? I wasn't ready to ask those questions. And so getting married young, it just seemed like believing in this story that I had been taught, this idea that if you follow the rules, things will of course turn out well.
There's a moment when you're married to Aaron and you ask him at one point, do you mind if I take off my hat? Which was kind of a big deal. And it was this odd situation. Like, I'm guessing he probably would rather you didn't take off your hat, but he sort of said, well, I suppose if you want, but what does it mean? I mean, that seemed like such an interesting moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are rules in Orthodox Judaism that are non-negotiable, observing the Sabbath, keeping kosher, certain things that if you are Orthodox that you basically follow.
Yeah.
And then there are other ones that people would consider to be the absolute law as well, but are not fully observed in every part of the Orthodox Jewish community. And so one of those is the idea of hair covering for women when they get married, that women wear either wigs or hats when they get married, with the idea that their hair becomes for their husband's eyes alone. And so I did that. I followed this idea, and I wanted to be someone who was regarded as serious about her religion. And yet for me, it was an immense struggle to cover my hair. It was a struggle to do something that felt so at odds with how I really felt and what I believed. But I, for years, did it until I really began to ask, could I really do this in the long run? Could I do something that felt so incompatible with my own, with my feminism and my own sense of my autonomy of my own body? And I asked my then husband, you know, I said, you know, would you mind if I stopped doing this? Because I knew it would reflect on him as well. It wasn't just my own action.
Sure.
And I think the idea of changing once you're married is very scary. We got married with the idea that we're perfect.
We're in.
We are the same.
Yeah.
We are the exact same. And I felt like if you start off the same, well, of course you're going to end up the same, because no one could possibly change. I mean, the idea of change was impossible to imagine. And yet here I was a few years into the marriage and I was changing. And I think that part of what I was afraid of most was by changing, by becoming different in a religious way, or by becoming less religious, do you risk losing the love of the people closest to you? Does religious change cast you out from the people who are supposed to love you and who you love? I think in asking him, do you mind, I think maybe that was one of the dynamics that was very much part of our marriage, that sense of, is there space inside this marriage for me to become myself? Is there room here for me to change from the person who I thought I was going to be and from the person who I am now becoming?
Yeah. And was there? Because he asks you at that point, do you think you're going to change anymore? Are you going to keep doing this, basically, is what he's saying.
Right. Is this the end point, or is this just the starting point?
Right.
And
right.
I think with a lot of change, we don't always know. I wanted to reassure him and say, no, of course not. I'm the same. And I think I wanted to believe it myself. I wanted to say, no, I will always be this person. And yet we change. Life brings about circumstances. We don't always know where we're going to end up. We learn new things. And change is part of life. And I think for me, that idea was very threatening, because it meant that we might not change in the same direction. Ultimately, I felt like there was not space for that kind of change. I think I came to see And I understood it, that he was afraid of my change.
Sure.
And I understand it fully. When you feel that someone you are married to is not the person you thought they were going to be, and certainly around something like religion that is the foundation of life, it upends everything. And I think for me, it felt like coming to know that trying to become my authentic self and trying to step into what I really believed endangered the relationship where I was supposed to be my full self.
Yeah. Have you ever wondered if you fell out of love with Aaron because you stopped being alike in the way you thought about the world, or that you stopped thinking this way and thought, I can't love him in that same way? Have you worked all of that out, do you think?
I've asked myself that question a lot. You know, which one was it? You know, people have said,
which came first?
Right, exactly. People have said, well, if you were in a marriage you were happy in, couldn't you have just stopped being orthodox and stayed in the marriage? Or some people have said, you know, don't you think that really you were fine with Orthodox Judaism and it was just the marriage that was the issue, you know, trying to untangle them.
Yeah.
And I think they're intertwined. I think it's hard to separate them out. I felt like they were sort of two issues that were running on parallel tracks, but always crossing at different points, though, because I felt that the marriage required me not to see things that I was trying to see, to ignore dynamics or to ignore issues where I did not feel I could be my full self. And religion was the biggest area where that took place, that feeling that I had to uphold something that I did not believe in. And so I think there's something soul-destroying about trying to live something and to teach something and to be an image of something that you privately experience yourself or secretly experience yourself as not really being. And so any sense of intimacy was lost, any sense that I could share this. For me, the questioning of religion and the struggle to be part of a religious world that was all-encompassing, it was an enormous struggle. It was something that I thought about constantly. I wrote about it. It was really at the center of my own sense of who I was going to be. And to feel that there was no space inside my marriage for it really cut off the feeling that I could be known in any way or could know someone else in that sense.
It's interesting that there was a critique, and I think it was in the New York Times, a woman who was critiquing a number of Orthodox Jewish women writers. And she basically was saying that none of you are Orthodox. You don't live up to the Orthodox standard. And in some ways, she was right about that for you, but it really put you off. You didn't like the idea of somebody accusing you of not being Orthodox.
Right. Well, it's interesting. She was a writer who was newly Orthodox.
Right.
She had been a secular Jew who became Orthodox. And she wrote about how she saw the beauty of it and how it was a world where everyone was happy and everyone was content. And look at these writers. It was myself and two other writers who two of them were not Orthodox any longer. And there was me, who was still Orthodox, who were writing critical views of the Orthodox world. And I think what angered me most, I mean, her saying I wasn't Orthodox was sort of amusing in some ways, because I was. If Orthodox Judaism was defined as religious observance, I was
observant.
Fully observant.
Yeah.
And I think what bothered me most about her critique was her definition of religious experience. Her notion of being religious meant that you are all in all the time. You are always happy. You always believe. You look around you in synagogue and everyone around you believes. She wrote in a follow-up article, "What most people don't realize is that when Orthodox Jews are not at synagogue, they're home with their families. That is the full story to be told, that everyone here is happy. And it's not a true story about any religious world, about any group. Any person, even those who are fully within, have their own complicated experiences. Everyone has their messy moments, their faith issues, their family dynamics. This idea that the only story to be told about a religious world was this idealized version, to me, was so against what it means to write a novel, to have a sense of human experience. I think being religious does not exempt you from the full range of human experience. And I think privately, many of us knew that to be true, to say, I observe, but I doubt, or I observe, but this is hard for me, or my family doesn't look perfect like it's supposed to. And it's so alienating and so lonely and shaming when someone comes along as a scold and says, no, no, there's only one story to be told here. It's not true. And so I think that was the part that really angered me the most. She could parse whether I was Orthodox enough or not, but her notion of religious experience to me was what really got me angry.
How did the family take it when you finally broke it to them that you didn't want to live an Orthodox life anymore. Right. I mean, you write about this in the book. I'll ask you about your brother's reaction, which I found particularly interesting. But generally speaking, didn't take it well.
Right. Well, for anytime your 40-year-old daughter calls, you know, your parents and says, "Hi, Mom and Dad, you know, just wanted to tell you, you know, I'm getting divorced and I'm no longer going to be Orthodox." You know, it's much to take in that moment. And, you know, I think when I first said it, there was that moment of silence at first. And in that moment, I filled in all these possibilities. Were my parents going to try to talk me out of it? Were they going to be angry at me? Were they going to reject me? And really, to their immense credit, really, you know, I'm so grateful for their response, which was to say, "We will be here for you." And which wasn't to say it was what they would have chosen for me, and it didn't match their own sense of belief. But I really credit my parents with accepting the fact that adult children get to choose their own lives, that we don't get to choose our children's faith for them. We can wish things for them or try to teach them or want things. But really, we're all entitled to autonomy and the integrity of our own belief systems. And I feel like my parents were willing to grant me that space. And, you know, it's interesting in my family, we really span a spectrum. My brother is part of an ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. And my sister is very similar to my parents and is modern Orthodox. And I was once explaining that to my middle son, who loves sports and sort of sees everything as a sports statistic. And I told him how, you know, there's me and there's your aunt and your uncle. He said, "Oh, so I guess, you know, my grandparents must feel like they're one for three in this."
Right.
So, and, you know, I told that story to my father, and to his credit, he said, "No, we're three for three," which is really nice. But that sense of do we need our children to match who we are?
Yeah.
Do we? You know, I have three kids, and I used to think the hardest part of parenting was holding on tight, was when they're running circles around me. And I've learned as I've gotten older, the hardest part of parenting is letting go. It's letting your children become their own people.
Your brother told you this. Let me quote it from the book. He said, "Don't think you can so easily walk away. A Jew can't divorce faith. It's not possible to do so. A Jew and faith are inextricably linked." How did you respond to that idea? And he also says this. I want you to comment on this. He says, "When you don't feel it, that's when you cry out to God. That's when you scream."
Right. He was coming from a position of deeply inside that world. And so for him, any question of faith could be answered with faith, and no question could topple the entire enterprise. There was always the sense that you wanted to stay within, and so everyone experiences doubt at one time or another, and yet you use that doubt to wrestle with the notion of God. And I welcomed his honesty. I was happy for the conversation. I wanted to hear that perspective. I said, I wanted to know, what does it feel like to fully believe, to feel absolute certainty that you hold the truth in your hands? There's something nice about hearing someone say it like they really feel it. And for me, I viewed it from a different position. I feel like once you do step through that door, you do question the premises, then it's a different story when you're willing to say, but is it true to begin with? Not how do I hold on to the truth, but I'm willing to say I don't know if it's actually true. It's a different conversation to have. And so I valued his conversation. I think it also helped me clarify. I think that until that conversation, I was hedging for myself. Did I just want a more liberal interpretation of it? Was I just looking for more of an egalitarian religious practice? You know, was I really going to leave? I think it clarified for hearing someone articulate their own absolute faith clarified for me the sense that I did not have that sense of faith.
Tova Mirvis is with us. Her memoir is called The Book of Separation. She is in Utah, just today, actually. Tonight at 6 o'clock, she's going to be signing books and giving a Q&A at the Community of Christ Church in Salt Lake City. We have information about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tova Mirvis. Her book is The Book of Separation. So you mentioned that, and in some of your books before, you were kind of working through what it meant to live an Orthodox life. You explored all of that. And you say you're still very interested in writing about religious communities, interested in how people, as you put it, live, you know, within the rules. I suppose Mormonism has to interest you in a similar kind of way.
It does. It interests me very much. I think that there's so many overlaps between our different worlds. I think to live in a religious community where it's not just something you do once a week or maybe a few times a year, you have a holiday or some abstract sense of believing, but when it really shapes your every single day, when it defines who is your community, who are the people you spend time with, when you feel that to belong to your family and community, you have to have the same set of beliefs. I've really been struck since the book came out how many people I've heard from within the Mormon community who wrestle in a similar way, who have a similar question about the relationship between the self and belonging to a community.
I'm guessing that the relationship, in terms of the rule believing, there's quite a connection, it seems, between these. I mean, there's certain rituals, there's certain rules, there's certain ways. The idea of observance, almost as much as important as belief, seems another one of those connections.
Right. It's not just belief is in an abstract sense, but do you practice?
Yes.
Are you inside?
Are you active, I think is the word, right?
Right. Active. Are you involved? And that feeling that if you break the rules, you find yourself on the outs. Not just that you have broken a religious rule, but you are no longer inside the community. And that feeling of what it means to leave and the searing sense that if you follow your own thoughts or ideas or feelings, you could find yourself severed from a community and from your family and from the people who you love the most.
What do you miss?
I do miss things. I think any notion that you leave and just walk away into some happily ever after free world is certainly not my experience. I miss the sense of belonging. I think for many people, belonging is what keeps them inside.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than belief, even more than ritual, that sense that this is my community and this is who I am in the world.
Is that okay? Is that okay if they – you chose that I can't – reconcile these two. I can't do this. But do you ever say to people, look, I don't really believe it, but I want to stay in because I like the hymns. I like the ritual. I like the culture of it. Is that a legitimate reason for staying, do you think?
I do think it is. I think there are many reasons we become part of communities, and they don't always have to be in the same way that I would want to step away from black and white thinking in a religious way. I would also want to step away from it on the other side to say, you can't do this. You know, it's not true. You can't do it. I think that many people, we all come up with sort of compromises about belief and belonging and ritual. And I think what is hard is when you're not allowed to say, I don't really believe in this. I think the damage or the danger comes in being required to pretend. I think what happens, you know, to you is that there's a sense that there's a private part of me, a dangerous self that cannot be articulated. I have to mask the non-belief and perform as if I believe. And that, I think, is the hardest part. I think to say, do I believe theologically these are absolute tenets? Like, no, probably not, but I want to belong. I think when there's space to articulate that complicated relationship is when I think it works better.
You say in the book there's still loneliness.
Right. I think loneliness is always part of leave-taking, especially in the beginning. And I think maybe one of the most moving experiences for me since my book has come out is hearing from so many people who have left different kinds of religious worlds. And I think loneliness is part of it. There's always that sense that you're stepping away from a collective, from an institution, from an organized world, and all of a sudden there's no clear answers to your questions. There's no what we believe or what we do. You have to all of a sudden formulate your own sense of the world. And in some ways, one of the reliefs of belonging was I didn't have to think that much about what I really believed. Yeah. I just thought, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to stay. And do I really believe, or how do I reconcile this problem of faith, or how do I reconcile this question? And I would just say, just don't think about it. Just go on with it. And part of leaving is having to reconcile those questions. Loneliness also creates opportunities. It creates the possibility of asking yourself what you really think. I think it opens up the chance to really to know that you can be alone in a belief sort of way, that you can exist without adhering to an established set of beliefs. It opens up the chance also, I think, to connect with other people. I mean, in some ways, leave-taking has been lonely, but the antidote for that for me has been this sense of sharing this story and hearing from so many people who share it. It's a little less lonely when you realize that across so many faith communities, so many people share the experience of doubt and struggle and leaving.
There's a moment in the book where you write about your son who is wanting to live an Orthodox life, asks you to unscrew the refrigerator light for the next Shabbat. And you say that you will, even though you've stopped living an Orthodox life at that point. And I wanted to talk about why. You say in the book that you did this to help your son be part of this world that he is choosing. And I guess it goes back to what you were saying before. If he's choosing it truly, you want to be a part of that. And so I guess I wanted to ask you about how you navigate when you don't want this Orthodox life, but your children who are still, of course, seeing their father who's living an Orthodox life, how you navigate that and how you compromise all of that.
Right. It's complicated. Yeah. All of a sudden, there's more than one way to be. And kids learn at a younger age, and they would, that there's not just one way to live in the world, not just one path you have to follow. And I feel like what I try to do is figure out how to have the widest possible birth in our family, the widest range, so that I can stay connected to everyone who I love. And in the same way that my parents, I feel like, gave me the space to say, this is not what they choose, but I'm allowed to become myself. I feel like my role as a mother is to talk to the kids about what I think and to hear what they think, to not just to teach them this is what you must believe, but to teach them how to ask questions. What I want for them most is not – I don't know that I want them to believe or not believe something. I don't have a clear vision of who I want them to be. I want them to be thinkers, and I want them to live with integrity, to live with a sense that they're not masking themselves. They're not forcing themselves to appear as though they are something. And so for my oldest son, he has felt a connection to the Orthodox world, and it's a world I raised him in and a world that he feels a sense of meaning and purpose in. And in the same way that I give my middle son space to not observe, I feel like the same openness is required of me in the other direction. We can't just be tolerant towards those who are like us, but toward those who choose other things. And I choose to accommodate. I choose, you know, for example, in my house now, I keep a strictly kosher kitchen, as I always did. And it might not be because I believe that I have a religious obligation to do so, but because I want my whole family to eat in my house. I mean, there's a certain irony to having left, and now I'm the kosher police officer in the kitchen, you know, being like, oh, not that, wrong way to do that. But I want to have the widest possible range of family and connection.
There's the story where you attend your sister's wedding, and you write about wanting to whisper some warnings to her. You want her to open her eyes, and you want to ask her, are you sure you want to do this? Are you really, really sure? Could you talk a little bit about this moment? Because you connected to this really great Sharon Olds poem called I Go Back to May of 1937, where she goes back and wants to talk to her parents as they're anticipating getting married.
I've always loved that poem. It's so funny to me that I loved it even when I was presumably a happily married young woman. But it's this moment where the poet wants to go to her parents and say, don't do it. You will regret this. You will hurt each other more than you can ever imagine. And, you know, being at my sister's wedding in the wake of my own divorce, I wanted to really ask myself those questions more than anything, that sense of my own 22-year-old self, that wish in some ways to turn back time and say, you know, do you really, you know, just think if you wait a little longer, or you don't know yet who you're going to become. And my sister got married when she was almost 40. And so she really had the opposite experience of, she was sort of what I had been afraid of being, that you know, it's called the singles crisis is how it's talked about in the Orthodox world, in the sense that, you know, we have to mobilize the community to deal with these older unmarried Orthodox, you know, members of our community. And I felt that, you know, being at her wedding, I think you do look at a wedding differently. You are aware that there are lots of ways every story can end. They're not only happy endings. But I also felt like, you know, I do feel regret. I feel like if I could turn back the clock, but I've also come to know and accept we don't get to change the past, that we learn things by going through them. And that sense that I got married before I knew what I was doing, but that in some ways is how I learned to become myself, by that experience of being in the wrong marriage and knowing that I needed to reshape my life.
There's this kind of theme in the book that you come to from time to time, and it's nature. how you are essentially finding God in nature. And you write about Rosh Hashanah, for example. You say on one hand, you don't want to be inside a synagogue. Mm-hmm. You don't want to feel obligated to do things. But you say the holiday still matters to you, that there's something mm-hmm. about it. And so you find, you, I guess, celebrate, maybe is the word, but in nature. And we were talking off the air a moment ago. Southern Utah, you've come to find God in that sense.
Yeah, it's the book spans from one Rosh Hashanah, one Jewish New Year, to the next. And the first one was going to a yoga and meditation retreat, which was, you know, seen as weird. Yeah. Certainly going to national parks is seen as like, what? You know, how could you do that for your Rosh Hashanah? But for me, that is really where I felt the most transformative sense of meaning and beauty. I think that in a lot of religious communities, you're taught to believe that you can only feel a sense of mystery and wonder and awe inside the religious world, that if you leave, you have no purpose. If you leave, you're cut off from any sense of beauty, that we have a lock on this. And I think, you know, if you spend a little time in Canyonlands or in Zion National Park, where I've spent one different Rosh Hashanahs for myself, you come to realize the world is much larger than that. And no one owns, no religious world owns beauty and majesty. No one owns that feeling of awe. And so my two favorite Rosh Hashanahs in my life, one was spent camping in Canyonlands and the other was in Zion National Park hiking the Narrows.
Let me ask you this finally. You say in the book that there was a time when you let yourself believe that there was only one kind of home and that yours had become irreparably mm-hmm. broken. But now you say, I have this day with the people I love. And I guess that's the way you just live, is like, this is, these are the people I love, and this is who I am, and this is where I am. And you can't really explain it much beyond that in some ways.
Right. I think it's so easy to have that image of how it's supposed to be, that idealized version of intact family and religious community, and my life looks like my parents does. This version, I think, that has haunted me my whole life, this sense that if you follow the rules, you will have this happy ending. And I think for so many of us, life becomes more complicated for reasons we choose and reasons that we don't get to choose. And I think for me, so much of the experience of leaving this world is not just leaving a community or a marriage, but leaving this notion of how our lives are supposed to look, how they must look, and accepting that things can look more complicated, that families come in lots of different ways, that we can reconstruct belonging in different ways, that meaning and purpose doesn't only happen in one way, but there are lots of ways for it to come to our lives.
Tova Mervis. Her book is The Book of Separation. She's going to be signing copies and giving a Q&A tonight at 6 o'clock at the Community of Christ in Salt Lake City. She's here as a guest of the Mormon Stories podcast. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Tova Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, directed by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.